Welcome to the Blue Stocking Circle podcast, Lady Nerds on Popular Culture. We're your hosts, Ashley,
B,
and Grisel.
And this is episode 5, The Secret of Nim. We'll be discussing the 1982 film, The Secret of Nim, an adaptation of Robert C. O'Brien's 1971 book, Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. The book won the 1972 Newbery Medal, which is given to the author of the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children, and is one of the most prestigious awards for children's literature in the country. Note: in the book, the protagonist's name is Mrs. Frisbee. During production of the film, the crew reached out to Wham-O, which is a great name, the manufacturers of the popular Frisbee flying disc toy that we've all played with and lost on someone's roof, and they reached out because they had concerns about possible trademark infringement. Wham-O refused to allow them to use the name Frisbee, so our heroine's name in the film had to be changed to Brisbee with a B. I personally think this is silly, albeit a fun little examination into how intellectual property law works, and so I'll be using the name Mrs. Frisbee in our discussions because that's the way it should be. And before we go any further, spoiler warning. The film is 35 years old, but as the other lady nerds have demonstrated, not everyone has seen it yet. So we suggest you stop listening if you're in that category and want to avoid spoilers. So without further ado, let's ask our newbie Grisel to sum up the movie.
The Secret of Nim is a classic animated film directed by Don Bluth of American Tail fame. Bluth formerly worked for Disney, and his style has many of the elements associated with early Disney films, including quirky characters and cute little animals. The Secret of Nim is the story of Mrs. Brisbee, nay Frisbee, because that's what it should be, a widowed field mouse with four children whose husband died under mysterious circumstances. Mrs. Brisbee's little boy, Timmy, is sick with pneumonia and cannot be moved because of his health, but the field where she keeps house is about to be plowed for the season, and they need to move or else. Mrs. Brisbee, therefore, goes on a quest to save her family and becomes involved in the machinations of the unusual rats of Nim, who live in the rosebush outside the farmhouse and may have something to do with her husband's fate.
Perfect. And now our origin stories. I will start since it's my, you know, my selection. And I came to this as a very young child. My grandmother watched my siblings and I during the summer and when we were on school breaks. And this is one of the few films that she had on VHS because, you know, the 90s. And this is actually one of those times that I saw the film first before reading the book, and they're very different experiences. But I love the movie because there was action and small animals and a lot of really interesting things going on. So I've never lost that love for it.
I know I read the book as a child, but it didn't make an impression and I didn't remember anything. I thought the movie was American Tail, like I said, in my first impressions. And I don't think I ever saw this particular movie as a kid since it didn't induce any traumatic flashbacks like Don Bluth's other works do. However, I have a different kind of origin story this time that drastically altered my viewing experience. You guys didn't know this until I mentioned it right before the recording, since this was when I was an undergraduate and graduate student before we met. But I started my research career working in biomedical laboratories funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, i.e. NIM. So that's the first thing I thought of when I saw the title of this movie, and I didn't suspect it was referring to the actual NIM until I heard the farmer's wife say the name. My research projects have always used human participants, since that's what I prefer, but I had to work with animal subjects as a student for training purposes, and those rows of caged rodents did give me traumatic flashbacks. Grisel, when we talked about cognitive versus affective responses to works in a persuasion episode, you said you thought affective responses depend on what we bring to a work ourselves, and I brought a lot this time.
I have to admit, I didn't realize that's what the initials stood for first either, and I thought that it would be like some sort of like magic thing.
Me too.
And then when I came to that scene, it kind of freaked me out a little bit.
See, and I thought about saying when we were talking about it, oh, by the way, NIM is what it is. And I said, oh, no, fine. They'll see it when the movie happens. I'm sorry. I probably should have told you. That would have helped a little bit.
So, So as I said in our first impressions episode, Ashley made me do it. But seriously, this is one of those classics that I knew about but had never seen. Like most children who grew up in the 80s and 90s, I am more than familiar with Don Bluth's work, having spent countless hours watching The Land Before Time, where of course I cried, and All Dogs Go to Heaven, before finally falling in love with Anastasia. Now, I knew a little bit about Bluth's style, but full disclosure, it wasn't until I watched Nim that I had a serious conversation with my animation-obsessed boyfriend about Bluth's history and style. So I will add that All Dogs Go to Heaven introduced me to waffles, so I have a whole other origin story involving Don Bluth, and thank you for that.
This episode segment of Ship Wars is a little different because there are no traditional romantic relationships in the movie, which I know B found refreshing.
I did enjoy that because so many of our movies, including the ones for children, prize romantic love above all other types of love. So it was nice to see a movie that focused on the love between a mother and her children.
And I also found it interesting because it started to hint at the potential for a romance, especially because Mrs. Brisby is a widow, and then she meets the very handsome, you know, head of the guard, Justin, and, you know, it looks like it's going to be a romance, but it doesn't push it. It never forces that, which I found interesting and quite refreshing as well, because so many will try to force a relationship just because that's the expectation in many movies, just to build either comedy or romance, and this was a nice change.
Yeah, no, I like that. I liked the depiction of the siblings because I thought that was very realistic. That's exactly how, you know, my sister and brother and I act. Like, we roll over each other, but they know he's sick. I wanted to, you know, take care of him. So I like that kind of, it's not a rivalry. It's not a, oh, she's the prettiest, she's the smartest thing that you get in a lot of fairy tale type of movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I thought that was a nice change.
There's this cute little mice and they're running around and nobody's battling each other or jealous of anything.
I will say, though, full disclosure, and I mentioned this on Twitter, I had the biggest crush on Justin when I was little. I understand he's a rat, but, like, he was just
He was very dashing.
He was really nice, and he's the captain of the guard, and he fought Jenner at the end. So, yes, I did have a little bit of a, oh, Justin kind of, you know, like, fangirl bit. But I'm glad that Mrs. Frisbee didn't, because it fits better in the movie, and that way Justin was all mine in my 6-year-old head.
I also found it very interesting that they kept that relationship very courtly, which is part of that, you know, like, Shakespearean tradition when you have a very courtly relationship between a knight and a lady. So I don't know if that was intentional, but Justin is definitely a knight, and it had a lot of that courtly relationship trope where there's nothing really sexual happening. You just admire one another. He helps her. He protects her. He helps her do what she has to do, and that's just it. Like, there's nothing else.
Doesn't she bandage his arm?
She does. So she kind of, like, gives him her favor.
Her colors,
so
yeah.
So it was very nice and a little different.
Okay, so if we have any medieval scholars out there and you want an idea for a paper, courtly love
courtliness
in the 1980s animated children's film, you're welcome.
There you go.
And now it's time to smash the patriarchy with a good old feminist rant. We haven't discussed it yet, but I thought this might be a good time to introduce the Bechdel test, or the Bechdel-Wallace test, as it's otherwise known. This test is named after cartoonist Alison Bechdel, in whose comic strip Dykes to Watch Out For, it first appeared in 1985. The test asks whether a work of fiction features at least two women who talk to each other about something other than a man. The requirement that the two women must be named is sometimes added. The Bechdel test isn't foolproof by any means. 4 years ago, when the film Pacific Rim came out, Michael Mori, the female lead, was strong, educated, and the top of her field. She also happened to be a woman of color, she was never dressed in skimpy outfits that bore no relation to her actual profession, and she was respected by the male lead in the film from the very beginning for her abilities and for her mind. However, the film famously generated discussion about how it still failed to pass the Bechdel test because there was simply no other female characters for Mako to talk to. Technically, one could argue that Nim passes the Bechdel test because Mrs. Frisbee and Auntie Shrew discuss Moving Day, although those discussions quickly move to focus on Timmy and Moving Day in relation to Timmy's illness, so you can argue both ways. So what do you guys think? Do you think it's a feminist work? Do you think that if it doesn't pass Bechdel, it should still count as a feminist work?
I was pleasantly surprised to see the protagonist was a female mouse. I had assumed, because in my mind this movie was American Tail, that the protagonist was a boy like Fievel, so I was pleased to see that it was a woman leading the film. Well, a female mouse, not technically a woman, but still. However, I don't know if she was technically named. They never refer to her as anything other than Mrs. Jonathan Brisby, and they don't even say her first name. For example, Mrs. Eleanor Brisby. She's always referred to only by Jonathan's name, Mrs. Brisby and Mrs. Jonathan Brisby. So does that count?
I don't know, but I did catch that, not as a child, but upon rewatching it, that she was never given her own name, which fail Don Bluth and producers, because I understand that being Jonathan's wife is an important part of the story and of, you know, how everything happens. But you could give her a real name. It's not like that's going to hurt anything.
Is she named in the book?
She is not. There's one point where she remembers meeting Jonathan, but in this, like, flashback, Jonathan doesn't even tell her, oh, I'm so happy to meet you, Patricia, or whatever her name should be. So, no, she is an ungiven-named character, which, looking back, again, not cool.
I find that interesting. First, I also did not realize this was about a female mouse, mostly because I had only ever seen the cover of the film, and you can't really tell by looking at the illustration on the cover that she's a girl. She's only wearing a little red cape. It could just as easily have been a boy. So I guess that says a lot about my understanding and my own personal biases. I assumed it was also like American Tales, a quest with a boy character, and everything on the cover is like magical or mysterious. So I made a judgment call there and assumed this was about a boy and was pleasantly surprised when it was about a little girl mouse. I will say I didn't really notice the whole thing about the name. It's curious. I probably just dismissed it as a sign of the times and her being a widow and keeping her husband's name, and knowing now that this was a children's book written by a man, especially like it was in the 60s, you said.
But 71.
In the 70s. So in the film, I got the feeling that the time period was like late 50s or so. So I can kind of forgive it as just being a product of its time and knowing that, you know, in middle America, particularly, and this looks like it's filmed, like it's supposed to be Kansas or something like that. They're in a field. That's kind of a thing. You take your husband's name and that becomes a thing. Now, knowing that in the book, they never said what her name was before she was married is really weird. Probably just something the author was used to and didn't even think about. So not that I'm forgiving it, but I can kind of see where it's coming from.
Something else that I thought was interesting about it, and we kind of discussed it earlier in Ship Wars when we were saying that it's a story about a mother and her children and not necessarily, you know, romantic love kind of thing. I like the fact that it was those very traditional female roles, her love for her kids, her wanting to make sure that her family is safe. That's what kind of gave her the strength to do everything. She escaped the cage. She went to go put the powder in Dragon's food bowl, not because she was really brave and she wanted to prove something to herself, but because she knew this was the best way to get what she needed to get done to save her family. She escapes the cage because of the same thing, even though she's hurt. So I kind of like that. I don't know if it's turning on its head so much, but this idea that you don't have to be a big, strong hero. You can be someone who's kind of scared and kind of quiet and can still get things done. And that makes you powerful. So again, as a little girl, I really appreciated that. And then even more now as an adult.
I did find her timidness, especially in the beginning, a little frustrating because she's so scared of going to Mr. Ages. And then she's so scared of Auntie Shrew and she's so scared of everyone. And I see that it changes and she grows as a character. But I found it really annoying in the beginning because I was like, just move your house already. Just get out of there. And, you know, and she's so scared of everyone. But, you know, I can see how that's part of her personal heroic quest and journey. And she does grow and change. But in the beginning, I was just like, move the kid already. He won't die. Just move him.
See, I was like that too when rewatching it. And then I was trying to think, okay, well, you know what? Who knows how long ago she lost her husband, and she's a mouse, so she's going to be more timid, and she's just shy. So I was kind of explaining all that away, just because, yeah, I was actually more annoyed with her not standing up to Auntie Shrew. I was like, lady, this is your home, these are your kids, you can tell this nosy neighbor to mind your own business. That was my little, I don't know if it's anti-feminist, because I should be nice to Auntie Shrew, but I was annoyed with her character a little bit.
I loved Auntie Shrew, though, which is funny, because I would not have ever liked that character as a kid because she is supposed to be the meddlesome, annoying person. Mm. But I found her very practical and I enjoyed her sense of practicality because she's like, the plow is coming. We got to get out. It's going to have happen eventually.
Going back to Mrs. Frisbee, I enjoyed her arc as well, how she went from very timid to at the end being courageous. And I appreciated that the movie specified it was an act of courage. Usually for female protagonists, it would be an act of love or an act of kindness. This was not kindness, this was not love. According to the movie, this was courage and strength. So I really enjoyed that that's the name they gave to this quality that she had, because you don't see that much with female protagonists. Usually it's courage that's ascribed to the male protagonist.
That's true. I didn't really notice that until you pointed out. But yeah, they imply that she has like a strong heart and she wins this and she saves the day because of whatever inner courage she's got, not really loyalty or sacrifice or all the other traits associated generally with female heroes. So there is one last thing I would like to rant about, and that is that very persistent crow and his love nest. What was that about?
He just wanted to find true love, which, you know what? After having this discussion, now I'm appreciating even more that it was the male
character who was all about, I want to find my one true love and build her a nest with the string and the shiny and the shiny, give me more shiny.
The shiny.
I hadn't put that together, but I like that that was happening from the male perspective, when traditionally it's a lot of times it's the female who is all about finding a mate and finding happiness. So come on, Jeremy.
I have a bone to pick, Ashley. You said that Jeremy was one of your favorite childhood characters.
Yeah.
When I said that Wolf from the 10th Kingdom was one of my favorite childhood characters, you expressed contempt, and they are the exact same character type. They are indeed. They're both obsessed with marriage. The only difference is that Wolf is pursuing the protagonist and Jeremy is not, and Wolf is competent and Jeremy is not.
Okay, but Jeremy never expressed, you know, like, sexual, I'm going to eat you. Maybe I'm not going to sexually eat you. I'm going to actually eat
different
you.
Different audiences.
I know.
Jeremy, different audiences.
Wolf was, you know, a little bit more because he's a wolf. Jeremy's just bumbling.
Like, he almost get them all eaten by dragon.
So. Because he's bumbling and he's dumb and you kind of want to hug him because he's so just intent on what he wants and he doesn't know how to get it. And he was funny because when he's hanging upside down and his little feet are in the air. Maybe it's more I like the physical comedy as okay. a kid. And he's all wrapped up and he goes, ah! And he falls over when he's wrapped up in the string. And then when they tie him up and they call him a turkey, a big turkey, and then another turkey. I'm not selling this.
They're the same character, Ashley. The fact that they both keep talking about how what they can do to make themselves appealing to women. Jeremy goes to Mrs. Frisbee for advice, but Wolf goes to a psychologist.
This is the true thing.
But Wolf keeps pursuing Virginia, even though she told him no and back off and slow down.
And Jeremy is the exact same thing off screen.
He does, actually, with Mrs. Frisbee. I thought that's where that was going. It didn't, but at first, I thought that's what was happening.
But it did it, and then when he found the girl turkey, the girl crow, to quote Cynthia, and she's very obviously into him, so it's okay that he pursues her and asks for a string because she's all about his Jeremy-ness. But I just thought he was really funny. As a kid,
I understand that. I'm just saying, you called me out for my childhood favorite, and now I'm calling you
out. Your honor has been questioned. I think we need a duel.
Jeremy versus Wolf. Wolf would win.
Ashley is a black belt, but I fence, so we'll see how that goes.
The question is, which one of us is a faster runner? Because if I can run away, then I win automatically. Haha.
Crystal, you're the neutral party here. Settle this.
Didn't we, like, determine that I was chaotic neutral now last time?
That was me. I'm the chaotic neutral one. You're just the plain evil one.
I'm the plain evil? Oh my god.
Because you like Turkish delight.
I do like Turkish delight. I throw things, so I would throw something at both of you and just run away too. I'm not calling this fight.
Okay, well, now that my world has been shaken a little bit at its core, we will move on and air out the other feels with a cup of tea in Catharsis Corner. And this is certainly not unique to Nim, but watching it again as an adult, I just really dislike that trope where the bad characters in films are ugly and the good characters are pretty. And I really, really, really dislike the trope where the bad characters are drawn darker than the good characters. I mean, there's a lot that can go in there in terms of, like, racism and, you know, sociology. And even here, like, looking at it again, Justin and Mrs. Frisbee are light brown rats. Mr. Ages is white. Jenner is black and gray and just really threatening. And I get that you want to make a visual distinction, especially with a children's movie, because it's easy to show different characters and make it easy for kids to follow, especially in a movie like this where there are a lot of different characters running around. And they're all rats, so it's not like you can make one, you know, wearing this dress or that dress, although they do wear clothes. I just thought that that was something that may be a little tone deaf in terms of how that portrays people and what can be extrapolated from that.
I didn't latch onto that. What I did latch onto, and this is very common in other Don Bluth works, is he demonizes cats like nobody's business. Like in every Don Bluth, the cat is always some sort of hellish creature. And in this one, not as bad as in some of the others. Like American Tail is really horrible. Bad about the cats. But Dragon is like the main villain in some ways, because I feel like he gets more evilness than even Jenner does. So
yeah, from the very beginning, you just see him just looming. He always has ominous
that
music.
One character from the start that you know is going to kill you, that and the plow. Like, they're the two biggest threats to Mrs. Frisbee and her children, other than pneumonia. Because then Jenner just kind of gets tossed in at the very end. I do notice now what you're saying about the distinction in the shades. I hadn't really, like, picked up on that. What I did pick up on is that Jenner is very smooth. Like, he's got, like, that smooth, like, Prince John sort of look. Like, He seems like he's more sophisticated than some of the other rats. Maybe not so much Jeremy. I mean, not...
Justin.
Justin. Why are they all J's? Dude, this is hard to keep track of. So he's not, you know, Justin is also pretty smooth, but you can tell that Jenner is like that smart person who will be wily and trick you into doing something. And he's got that like smooth back hair and he's like the silver fox of this world or something. So I don't know. He's evil in many ways, but cats still.
Says the cat lover.
Says the cat lover, of course. I'm disturbed by this. My biggest pet peeve with this was, what happened at the end? Because if there is an example of Deus Ex Machina, it's like science and then, but no magic. You know, like, how does this whole story get resolved with a magic necklace that came out of nowhere? There's no other magic in this story. Why is there a magic necklace? What is the purpose of this magic necklace?
Who is doing this research and how can I get that grant?
I know.
I don't know. In the book, it's one of those times where the book and the movie are very different. In the book, it's all very scientific. They use a system of pulleys and levers, and they move the thing in 10 minutes because Archimedes and physics, and it was not a problem. And watching again,
I got so excited. Physics saves the day.
In the book, physics saves the day. All they do is the rats go, they take a look at it, they say, okay, we use a fulcrum, we have this point of leverage, literally 10 minutes, grab some rollers, and we're done. So I'm telling you, I really need you to enjoy.
I'm all about magic, but this made no sense to me. And I was like, as a 5-year-old, maybe I would have bought it. But as an adult, I'm just watching this going, what?
I was stuck on the fact that it says that Nim made the rats and the mice, well, at least Jeremy and Mr. Ages. Not Jeremy, Jonathan. You're right.
There's a lot of J's. There are a lot of J's.
That it made them smart. But then, why is Mrs. Frisbee talking and wearing clothes? Because she wasn't part of the experiment. Why is Auntie Shrew talking and wearing clothes? When we see the rabbits, they look like normal, non-talking, non-clothes wearing animals. What is going on here? I will get the owl. He's magic.
Modesty.
Then if he's the one who taught her to talk, just like he did to read, then I don't want to think about the implications of that.
Pygmalion.
You know, I hadn't thought of that, the wearing clothes, because I just, as a kid, I just watched it and accepted it. I guess in my head...
This is a whole other movie now.
Yeah, the main characters wore clothes because that's how you knew they were the main characters versus the animals in the back. That's a good point. I'll throw the book in again. All animals in the book know how to speak. Obviously, the rats don't speak to humans and all that, but they can talk to each other. So what Jonathan teaches Mrs. Frisbee is how to read, not speak, because she already knew how to speak before. So I don't actually have a good question other than... This was Don Bluth, like we said, first film, and I think he was actually trying to fit a lot in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I know, Griselle, you were saying that you talked with your boyfriend about the animation style and the background.
There's a lot of talk about the animation style.
There is, and one of his things is he likes to really focus on the backgrounds. Yeah. He likes to make sure
that... details to everything. The minute that it starts and Nicodemus's hands come out, he's like, look at all the details in the gnarled fingers. I'm like, only you would get excited by this.
Like, you know, in the rose bush, you see each little thorn, and the background is not just painted. So I'm gonna go with maybe he was so excited to have his own studio where he could like focus on all the little things that he kind of lost track of the big picture.
I can see this.
Maybe that's
first time
writer, directing,
director, etc. You want to throw all your stuff into this one basket and you go with it. So I still can't buy the magic, but I'll take that explanation.
I am glad, Ashley, that you said science saved the day in the book, because that was one of my complaints about the movie. It had a very anti-scientific perspective. I got angry watching the movie, the way the lab scenes were depicted. The lab was depicted as being dark and foreboding and ominous. The scientists were only
very scary.
They were off screen and the hands rushed in and grabbed the rats and viciously injected them. It was just, it would not pass any iCook standards the way it was depicted in the movie. However, I did some research. I don't know if you know this, Ashley. I figured the Nim reference was too specific. There had to be some background here. And it turns out this is based on a real study Nim conducted in the 1940s to the 1960s. Did you know about that?
I did not know this.
Yes. So basically what they did, and I'll put the article in the show notes, was they got rats and they put them in a barn and they created a rat utopia. So no predation, no dragon running around, unlimited food, basically anything a rat could possibly want or need. And when that happens, the rats kept breeding and overpopulating and eventually got really, really crowded in that barn. And when it got really crowded in that barn, the rats turned on each other. They started attacking each other, they started killing each other. The movie calls it the terrible cruelty of Nim, and I resented science being called terribly cruel, but this was a terribly cruel experiment to rats. The article does go into detail, so that's what this movie is based on. And I can understand now the perspective the movie takes.
Well, that adds a whole other layer to, you know, knowing that, to the world that Jenner wants to make. So, you know, because there is a little bit of politics in the movie, and it's kind of like the magic, like it just kind of comes out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So the idea of a utopia where people aren't killing each other and you can kind of like live on your own, that adds a whole other layer to our understanding of this, if that's where the inspiration came from.
I was reading that the author basically thought, what if a few rats escaped from this horrible nightmare Hunger Games and created their own society, and that's where the rats in this movie supposedly come from, that barn.
Yeah, that scene was really intense and totally came out of left field for me, because again, I thought this was, you know, happy children's tale about magic, because that's what the cover implies, you know, a little mouse in a red cloak and some sort of magic necklace thing. And when that scene comes out, that was intense. They really just went for it.
And that's something that, again, as a kid, I was just like, okay, it's the scary bit. I'm supposed to be scared by it to understand why the rats are there. As an adult, I was still a little scared, but I was also kind of upset because, like you said, I think there's something, you know, like you said, it's not at all how labs are run. And this is that one specific experiment that you're talking about is one specific experiment. Mm-hmm. But as a general rule, that's not like that. And then in the...
Yeah, I mean, as we know, a lot of ethical changes happened with the way science is run. There were terrible human experiments done in the early 1900s. Yes. And
around that same time period, the mid-20th century had a spate of horrible experiments on both humans and animals. Mm-hmm. And I want to reassure everyone, as a scientist in the group, there are two institutional bodies at every organization that does research. It's called the Institutional Review Board for Human Research and the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, or IACUC, for animal research. These are people who go around checking every lab to make sure that animals are being cared for. These are people who you have to submit your study before you even start conducting it, and they have to approve everything you plan to do, all the way from your choice of participants to how you plan to store the data to who's going to have access to that information. Everything right now is very strictly monitored, so a study like this could not happen again in today's climate. And I want to reassure everyone that scientists are not evil.
They are, and then I will chip in with the little tidbit that in the book, that's not at all what happens. The scientists that take care of the rats take care of them. They're treated humanely. They're kind to them. They talk to them. The rats escape because the rats gain human-level intelligence and obviously don't want to live in a cage. And at that point, since they've learned to read, they can read where it says to open the cage, push the lever, and they're like, okay. And they push the lever, and there they go.
Always a lever.
There's always a lever. Oh, they can, Emperor's New Groove.
The Tenth Kingdom, lever.
That's true.
See?
Levers are important pieces of... Are they deuces? They're not deuces matching them. They're important.
No, that's just like...
Important aspects.
An element of life. There are levers.
They're a literal machina.
Literal machina.
I'm glad you say that, Ashley. I kept thinking, why did it have to be the terrible cruelty they're escaping from? Why couldn't it be a case of the mice and the rats thinking they wanted much more than this provincial life?
10 points to me. 10 points to Ravenclaw for the Beauty and the Beast reference. But that's in the book, that's literally what it is. Okay. It's... They want a life on their own, not in a cage, which I can't blame them. And then the people from NIMH coming back to get them are not coming back to raise the rose bush and kill them. They just want, from their perspective, they want their experiment back because they want to see what happened. And clearly they know that it was a success if they were able to read and escape. So it's a little, it's one of those times where now having rewatched the movie as an adult, maybe the book would have been, or maybe a more true adaptation to the book would have been better. Especially for considering how much responsibility producers and, you know, artists have when they're trying to replicate truth. You know what I mean? Because NIMH was a real place. So how much are you throwing like shade on scientists by doing this? Even if you're talking about a very specific point in time, the movie doesn't exist in a point in time. Movies exist, you know, across time. Mm-hmm. So I apologize for any pain.
Traumatizing
it might have caused
us.
BS, yes. As a science for traumatizing.
Can I share a story?
Of course.
Before you're allowed to work with vertebrates, you have to work with invertebrates. So my training in animal research started with our favorite species, the cockroach. I had to conduct my very first experiments with
a
cockroach.
Sounds like a Hagrid-style class. Like, you start with the scroots before you upgrade.
Well, that's what it was like. I eventually moved on to crayfish and other invertebrates before I even got to see the mice in their cages. But just so you know, the way you anesthetize a cockroach is you place it under a plastic cup with no holes, along with a piece of dry ice. Eventually, the cockroach will go to sleep, and you can do all your little experiments on the cockroach, and you have to do it quickly, because if that thing wakes up, it's going to be very aggravated that you're poking it. And then it's going to fly around the lab, and you're going to have to run down 3 flights of stairs and across the street and into the Starbucks, and you're going to have to wait there until someone from your lab comes to get you to tell you that cockroach has been contained again. And that is a true story.
Oh my God. I will admit to being
But there is speciesist. A lesson here. Have dry ice in a cup in your house if you come across a cockroach.
I was just thinking I need to invest because while the thought of like experiments on mice and rats and rabbits, the way they were portrayed like in the movie freaked me out, I have no problem with you doing whatever you want to cockroaches. I'm really sorry. I apologize to any, you know, cockroach aficionados out there, but no.
But even then, 90% of humans would not hesitate to step on this creature, and yet we had to anesthetize
it. Your experiment could have been destroyed in seconds.
Good point. Just no. Go ahead and step on it if you want. Just okay, so now it is time for us to give The Secret of NIMH a sock rating out of 5. Griselle, as a newbie, do you want to go first?
I'm always the harsh one, and I'm always thinking of what else I gave as far as ratings and how to measure this. Now, after this discussion, I think I appreciate it more, so I'll give it a 3, maybe? I don't know. 2.5 to 3, somewhere in there?
I'll take 3.
Okay. Keep your 3.
Okay, I'll keep my 3.
I'm going to be the harsh one. I also appreciate it more after our discussion, but I'm only going to give it 2.5, and I'm sorry, Ashley.
That's fair, because after a discussion and thinking about it, now I'm like, I still love it, but now I have that sheen of like adult reality looking at it. So I think I'm going to drop it down and give it a 3.5 instead of the 4 that I was going to give it originally. I still love it, but objectively,
it still comes out to a 3 average.
Still averages, yeah.
Which is a positive, so I will take it. Yes.
So far, only Jane Austen has beat that 3 average.
But, you know, Jane.
Jane can't beat Jane.
So we'll move on to our reading recommendations. I want to start with an anti-recommendation. The film was followed by a direct-to-video sequel called The Secret of NIMH 2, Timmy to the Rescue, which was made without Bluth's involvement or input and is frankly really, really, really bad, so don't watch it. And if you do, don't blame us. Obviously, I'm going to recommend the original book, and there are, of course, a ton of differences between the book and the film adaptation, the biggest of which is probably the addition of mystical, magical elements in the film. The book also has 2 sequels, Raxo and the Rats of NIMH, and R.T., Margaret, and the Rats of NIMH, both of which were written by O'Brien's daughter, Jane Leslie Connolly. And if anthropomorphic woodland creatures are your thing, I strongly suggest that you check out Redwall by Brian Jacques, the first in a fantasy series featuring lots of adventure, growing up stories, and truly epic descriptions of feasts, parties, and food of all kinds.
For all your talking animal needs, The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis. This series includes my favorite of all talking mice, the valiant Reepy Cheep, who you can find in the books Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and, spoiler alert for a super famous 62-year-old book, The Last Battle. For adult rather than children's literature, Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes, published in 1966, makes an excellent pairing with The Secret of NIMH. The Algernon of the title is a mouse who undergoes surgery to be more intelligent. The novel is not about him, though, but about a man named Charlie who is the first human to undergo the surgery. It is an interesting exploration of scientific ethics, as well as an emotional story about human relationships, and Griselle, you are going to cry. If you want something quicker, Flowers for Algernon started as a short story published in 1959, but I think the full novel is worth your time.
Unlike you two, I wasn't sure what book to recommend, because I don't really do talking animals. It's kind of a quirk of mine. What I did find is that, as I was watching this, I felt some classic Disney nostalgia, particularly for Robin Hood. So that's my recommendation. Watch this movie and then watch Robin Hood and tell me Brisby's kids aren't replicas of the rabbit kids in that movie. Which, according to the wiki, Bluth worked on. So, just saying.
Yeah, you're right. Both Cynthia and then the baby mouse, the baby rabbit with the little bow, both of them have little bows in their hair and they run around. Mind blown.
As I was watching it, that's all I could. I was like, am I watching Robin Hood? Am I watching something else? Because they just looked exactly the same.
Okay, this might be the quickest time that someone ever follows a reading recommendation, because I'm going home today and rewatching Robin Hood now with that in my head. So next time in the Blue Stocking Circle, join us for Minnesota 5.5, where we will share our favorites, feedback, and first impressions, and announce the next title in the Blue Stockings lineup. Minnesota 5.5 airs on January 15th. In the meantime, you can find us at thebluestockingcircle.com, On Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and Tumblr, at Blue Sock Circle, socks spelled S-O-X, or email us at thebluestockingcircle@gmail.com. We're also available on Apple Podcasts and Google Play, so please rate, review, and subscribe to help us grow.
Cheers!
I hope this isn't recording because he sounds so proud. You pushed a button. Congratulations, Crystal.
That takes some serious effort to learn.
If you were a rat, admin, you'd be given a reward.
Ethically.
Ethical reward and good.
Right, that has been the Fun Facts Science Corner.
Oh, my God.
No, we can't do that because that's Night Vale.
Science saves the day.